2018 saw many important cases and issues that will shape False Claims Act enforcement today and in the years to come. In this five-part podcast series, we'll analyze some key developments to help you better be prepared if the government comes calling with tough questions. In this episode, we'll visit with Hogan Lovells partners Mike Tice from our Denver office, Peter Spivak from our Washington, D.C. office, and Jenny Gibson from our Philadelphia office, as they discuss the areas, cases, and trends they believe will have an impact on FCA enforcement moving forward.
Awesome. This is Mike Tice. I'm a partner with Hogan Lovells in Denver, Colorado, and this is the kickoff of the False Claims Act, The Road Ahead, a podcast where we're going to talk about the future of False Claims Act enforcement and what we are looking forward to in the coming year.
Hi, Mike. This is Jenny Gibson. I'm coming to you from our Philadelphia office of Hogan Lovells.
Awesome. And Peter?
Hi, it's Peter Spivak. I'm from the Washington, D.C. office of Hogan Lovells, where I've been for 21 years, and happy to join everybody today for this podcast.
Terrific. So we are looking ahead for False Claims Act enforcement to what we expect in 2019. But as is typical in these sorts of things, we start with a look back over the past year, and let's talk a little bit about the numbers. The Department of Justice announced that it recovered just over $2.8 billion in judgments and settlements under the False Claims Act, which is a bit off of fiscal 2017, when they recovered $3.5 billion. And in 2016, there were recoveries of $4.9 billion. So my first question is, do you think that that reflects anything significant? What inferences should we be drawing from the fact that it seems like recoveries were a bit down in 2018?
So, Mike, I would say that 1 or 2 years doesn't a trend make. There can be 1 or 2 cases that drive the numbers in many of the years. There may be a new change in the top of the administration that I would say may actually be more influential in False Claims Act actions, and that's Attorney General Bill Barr. You're talking about somebody who has probably a 30-year history of some hostility to the QTAM provisions of the False Claims Act. He actually was an author of a memo in July of 1989, almost 30 years ago now, when he was head of the Office of Legal Counsel, which is sort of the in-house think tank for the Department of Justice. And in that memo, he basically said that in his opinion, his considered opinion, the QTAM provisions are actually unconstitutional. So I think what we're going to see instead is more assertion by the Department of Justice in 2019 and possibly years after, with the administration's right to determine whether or not actions that are declined by the Department of Justice actually will go forward.
Let me follow up on that, Peter. There were announcements of two new policies. The so-called Granston memo was published by the Department of Justice, which speaks to the circumstances under which the department will consider moving to dismiss declined QTAM cases. And since the promulgation of that policy, there are at least some indications that the government is going to be much more active in seeking to dismiss declined QTAM cases. And then in January of 2018, the Brand memo was also issued by the Department of Justice. That then Associate Attorney General Rachel Brand issued a memorandum that basically limits the ability of department attorneys, trial attorneys in the civil division or assistant U.S. attorneys, to rely upon executive branch agency guidance in litigating False Claims Act cases. And that also seemed to be intended to curtail the application of the False Claims Act or limit the kinds of cases that could be brought, particularly where the department relies on agency guidance.
Mike, I think in our practice, we've seen throughout, well, since the issuance of the Granston memo, where the department made a very detailed description of the kinds of cases that it would consider moving to dismiss on its own and the factors that it would consider. Then in December, we saw what could be called a rash of motions to dismiss filed under the False Claims Act Section C2, which is the C2A authority, which basically says that the Department of Justice and the United States may file motions to dismiss civil False Claims Act cases for a number of reasons. And they were filed in multiple numbers in multiple federal district courts across the United States. So what we saw in those motions by the department's briefs have relied upon several grounds, but the primary one is the burden of discovery on the government, the potential waste of government resources that would occur if the department's own declination of a case is ignored and the QI-TAM relator proceeds forward to litigate the case without the department. Because, of course, the department continues to monitor declined QI-TAMs and has to make federal executive branch witnesses available for interview, for deposition, and various discovery burdens, because it's generally it's the government and not the relator who has that information that the whistleblower is seeking to prove its claims. The other grounds that the department put forward in the motions were a lack of merit and relator misconduct. The department was quite specific in the method of misconduct that it thought was problematic with relators, including creating information by a subterfuge, filing actions as whistleblowers under pseudonyms, etc. So you have a combination of frustration with relators, which has been simmering for many, many years in the government, and DOJ didn't do anything about it.
The other area where there was a modification of department policy was with respect to the modification of department guidelines regarding individual responsibility in corporate fraud investigations and cooperation credit in those investigations, something that is usually referred to as the Yates Memorandum after then Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates. Peter, I wonder if you can talk about the announcement that was made on November 29th about Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein's views about how that policy should be modified and what that might reflect with respect to how the agency, how the Department of Justice sees cooperation credit in civil cases going forward.
Thanks, Mike. Happy to do so. First, just a word about each of Granston and Brand as memos. I mean, in the Granston memo dismissals, if we can call them that, I think that one of the major features, including the many that Ginny mentioned, are the fact that in one of those cases involving a relator called the Health Choice Group, the department was very critical of the fact that there were multiple relators' actions brought by a professional relator. And the department pointed to the fact that there were 11 QI-TAM actions brought in 7 judicial districts, each essentially identical, and also critical by the fact that the entity behind that Health Choice Group was really a partnership of limited liability companies set up by investors and former Wall Street bankers. And so I think it was the fact that there was so much of an element of professionalism by the relators that was one of the major points that the department brought to bear in those dismissals to really try to cut off False Claims Act actions essentially as a vehicle for litigation funding or investment by professional relators and companies behind them. So that's Granston. As to Brand, I think we will see more Brand-type declinations because remember, this is an administration that has made one of its hallmarks to be the reduction in the regulations that are imposed on business. And when you've got an action for recovery in the name of the United States that's not even based on a regulation, but it's based on sub-regulatory guidance, I think that's really anathema to the current Department of Justice's approach to the regulation of corporate behavior. Turning to Yates, as you mentioned, Deputy Attorney General Rosenstein, what he announced as a policy was that you didn't have to have an all-or-nothing policy for cooperation. In other words, in a civil False Claims Act case, you don't have to, as the representative of the company, go out and discover each and every single person who is involved in the misconduct that's at issue. Instead, what you have to look for is people who are substantially involved. Now, the department has not really defined what substantial means, but that's a limitation that's really intended to say, look, we don't want essentially this cooperation credit to be turned on and off like a spigot. We've got to recognize that there are situations where it just simply is not possible or may not make sense to go after each and every person who's involved in misconduct. People may have left, they may have retired, they may be so far down the chain and so attenuated in their involvement. So it's really, I think, bringing some measure of rationality into the decision as to whether or not a company has cooperated sufficiently to get a reduction.
So before turning to the next sort of general topic, let me just ask you, what should we be concluding about all of these changes in department policy? Is there some through line that connects the Granston memo, the Brand memo, and the change to the individual responsibility policies? Is there some bigger inference that we should be drawing from all of this?
Mike, I think we could draw a number of conclusions. One is, I think these memos taken together are intended to swing the pendulum back a little bit, perhaps significantly, from where it had swung before in terms of what cooperation means. The combination of the cooperation credit, the Yates memo interpretation by different U.S. attorney's offices, and where, you know, at varying levels of aggressiveness and attention to Washington memos. But this is a way to kind of moderate the extreme interpretations that had been occurring in different U.S. attorney's offices and with some individuals at Main Justice. That if you come in and you give information and you're timely, but you don't have an individual for whom you can help the government draft an indictment, you still can get cooperation credit and you can still reach a reasonable resolution for your client rather than having interim threats against companies and individuals that are unfair interpretations of the level of culpability that they have.
I think that's absolutely right, Ginny. I think the other through line that comes across in all of this is, you know, a recognition that corporations are complex, multifaceted organizations, and the imposition of liability is a very blunt axe of regulation. And we're seeing, I think, an administration that doesn't want to hold corporations to a standard of behavior that may be impossible to achieve. And I think we've seen that in many aspects of administration policy across the board. Part of that, I think, is really just a desire to increase economic activity, improve business performance, et cetera. But I think we're seeing that carried out in this context in the realm of lawsuits, litigation, investigations, and actions by the government against corporations. So it's in some ways, it's a rebalancing, if you will.
So, Peter, you make a really important point about kind of the direction that the department seems to be going with respect to False Claims Act enforcement. And I would say that it seems like the courts are more inclined to try to find ways of limiting the application of the False Claims Act as well. The way that that has manifested itself has been with courts applying a very rigorous materiality standard since the Supreme Court decided U.S. X. Rel. Escobar versus Universal Health Services. Ginny, I'd be interested in your thoughts about how we are likely to see Escobar applied in the coming year, and whether it will continue to be a focus of dispositive motions, discovery, or in other ways in False Claims Act enforcement.
Yes, I think certainly from a process perspective, at each stage of a False Claims Act matter now, investigative, motion phase if the government files its complaint, and post-declination if the relator is going forward on their own, we will see vigorous arguments that the conduct complained of was not material to the government's decision to pay. And in the investigative stage, of course, that will be a lot of argument on the part of individuals and companies to which the government will not reply. So you won't learn much on whether it is material, but certainly a history or pattern of payment for the goods or services will be important information to bring forward to the government. And there's a lot of case law supporting those arguments. At the post-intervention stage or the post-complaint stage, we'll be seeing a lot of heavy motion practice, motions to dismiss for lack of materiality, whether it's the government litigating the case or the relator. And finally, we will see significant emphasis by courts, if they allow the case to go forward, to permit discovery by defendants of that very decision by the government to keep paying for a product or service of which fraud is complained about.
So the discovery component of this intrigues me, Peter. Have you seen that issue raised in any of the cases that you're working on? And how should defendants be thinking about the best way to use discovery to assist in raising these materiality arguments?
Well, I think that it certainly applies post-complaint, because that's when your discovery rights, of course, would attach. And I think that there's going to be a lot of activity around trying to seek that information from the government, determination whether you have to apply with the TUI regulations, for example, in obtaining information from a government witness. I think, though, we also have to be careful here, because we haven't quite reached equipoise in Escobar. And by that, I mean two things. I think, first of all, I think Relator's attorneys are going to become better at pleading materiality and fulfilling Escobar's specific requirements. I think the second thing that I worry about from the client standpoint is, if we continue to push, as we should, evidence of payment as evidence of a lack of materiality, we have to ask, what are we inviting in response? And are we inviting the government essentially to put everything on prepayment review or to cut off reimbursement? Because that could be actually devastating to the continuing viability of our own clients. So I think we've got to think through carefully on the defense side how we use those arguments and how we connect it up to evidence of government knowledge of the noncompliance at issue.
Yeah, from my perspective, Peter, what's interesting about this jurisprudence is that the Escobar materiality standard has resulted in the reversal of two massive jury verdicts in favor of relators in a couple of these cases. So just in the last year or year and a half, there was a $350 million jury verdict in U.S. Ex Rel Ruck versus Salas Rehabilitation. That was reversed for lack of proof of materiality after the jury verdict was entered by the court. And same thing or a similar thing happened in the United States Ex Rel Harmon versus Trinity Industries, $663 million jury verdict reversed on grounds that the relator had failed to provide adequate proof of the materiality of the claims. And I take your point well, Peter, that this could put some really close scrutiny on whether continued payment is something that the defendant and the government does or does not want. And if it means that payments will be suspended once there is a complaint is filed, I think that defendants could be quite concerned about that. Contractors, companies participating in programs don't necessarily want to see the government suspending payment while this is sorted out through the courts. Let me turn to another area, which is we're waiting for a decision from the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in the so-called Acericare case, U.S. versus GGNC, NSC Administrative Services. This is a case that dealt with the question of what evidence is sufficient to conclude that certification that a patient is terminally ill is actionably false for False Claims Act purposes involving claims for hospice care. The case actually went to a verdict in the district court, and then that verdict was reversed by a judge on a motion for summary judgment granted after the verdict was returned, was appealed to the 11th Circuit, and as I said, that appeal has now been pending for almost 2 years. In the meantime, there have been two appellate decisions that appear to have provided substantial additional support for the proposition that a doctor's professional medical judgment can be actionably false. The United States versus Paulus case in the Sixth Circuit and United States Ex Rel Polyakov versus St. Mark's Hospital in the Tenth Circuit. I'm interested in your thoughts, Peter, about what the Paulus and Polyakov decisions portend for the likely ruling from the 11th Circuit in Acericare, and if all of these cases may spell the end to an argument or a defense that the clinical judgment of physicians or other opinions of experts may not be actionable as false claims for purposes of the False Claims Act.
So, Mike, I would answer that as a no, but. And by that, what I mean is No, it does not spell the end to the argument that medical necessity should not be premised on proof of the fact that a doctors or experts may disagree about a diagnosis or a prognosis. But instead, as the court has said, it's got to be something that's at the extreme in that there are no facts to justify an opinion, or the facts are so slight as to justify the opinion. And I don't know if we can tell, based on Paulus and Polakoff, which way the AseraCare court will go. I mean, first of all, that case has been in front of the 11th Circuit for a very long time. So clearly there's something going on there in terms of why the court hasn't come out with its opinion. The second thing, though, is that dealt with prognosis or prediction of whether or not a patient has 6 months or less to live if the illness runs its normal course. In other words, the definition of a terminal illness. That's very different from a diagnosis, a, you know, deduction based on medical evidence. And so it may be that the court in AseraCare simply says, look, prognosis is different from diagnosis. When you're trying to predict something happening in the future, it necessarily adds an element of uncertainty. Patients behave differently. Patients react differently. Patients may outlive their life expectancy despite all evidence to the contrary. And it's more the method and the means by which the government is seeking to prove the issues in AseraCare, which was really having a doctor get up on the stand and say, this patient is not terminal based on what I'm looking at, ironically enough, retrospectively. And that is simply just seems it just a completely illogical way for the government to try to prove that a claim is false.
Yeah, that's a good point, Peter. The judge in AseraCare seemed to have been troubled by the proposition that on the question of falsity, the case really came down to competing expert medical opinions. On the one hand, the defendant's expert saying that the record supported a finding of terminal illness, and the government's expert saying exactly the opposite. And whether that was enough to conclude that a certification of terminal illness was false for purposes of the act. And sounds like what you're saying is the facts might be considerably different in a case that doesn't involve prognostication, but instead simply extracting diagnosis or something else from the record. So let me change topics again here and talk a little bit about what I see as another developing area that I'm not sure exactly how to predict what is likely to happen in this area, but there certainly seems to be a number of cases that are coalescing around a more conservative measure of damages than the government typically seeks in cases involving implied false certification, either in anti-kickback statute or other regulatory settings. The government quite often takes this position that it is entitled to recover on a so-called tainted claims theory that during the pendency of the period when the non-compliance with the regulation or the illegal remuneration is taking place, all claims submitted to the United States are false and actionable, and that the government can recover so-called tainted claims damages for all of the claims that were submitted. One of the things that appears to me is in several different cases, the courts have rejected that proposition. So I would point again to the Harmon versus Trinity Industries case. The Fifth Circuit rejected an expansive measure of damages in that case. In a Sixth Circuit case called U.S. X. Roll Wall versus Circle C Construction, same thing. The court really used strong language there to describe the government's damages theory as fanciful, noting that in a construction case, the government, you know, goes to work every day and the lights come on and everything works. And so how could they claim that they didn't get any value? You know, these cases seem to be following on a couple of older cases, the Anchor Mortgage case from the Seventh Circuit in 2013 and the so-called SAIC case, United States versus Science Applications International Corporation from the D.C. Circuit in 2010. I'm interested in your thoughts, Ginny and Peter, about whether I'm onto something here. Is there, do you think, a trend towards the benefit of the bargain rule in False Claims Act jurisprudence and away from this more expansive tainted claims theory, and how should defendants or companies be looking to use that to their advantage in litigation going forward?
Well, certainly, Mike, the trend of the cases you referenced and several additional ones is away from the government's theory that's really an interim theory they use in negotiations that have tried where they think their facts are good enough to pursue and have affirmed by a court. So anyone faced, any client faced with the notion that a claim that is at, in some respects false or associated with fraudulent conduct is 100% owed back to the government is not an easy argument for any court to accept. And I think it should be pressed fully by the defense.
I totally agree. I mean, I think that's, you know, this is an argument that I have made, you've made many times to the government. It drives me crazy because why should the government get a windfall? If our client has delivered the services or the goods and the government has received them and there's some falsity associated that doesn't impact what the government actually received, there's no reason the government should have that kind of benefit. And I think the courts are realizing that that makes absolutely no sense.
A related concept in these cases that involve violations of the anti-kickback statute that a couple of courts seem to have adopted is the notion that you have to prove causation for purposes of demonstrating False Claims Act liability predicated upon a violation of the anti-kickback statute. And here's what the courts have said about that or meant in these contexts. In the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, the anti-kickback statute was amended to include a provision that says that a claim that includes items and services resulting from a violation of the anti-kickback statute constitutes a false or fraudulent claim for purposes of the False Claims Act. That resulting from language imports to some courts anyway, the notion that that means you have to prove that the illegal remuneration actually caused the presentation of a claim, that it's not enough simply to show that there was some sort of a financial arrangement that resulted in the payment of remuneration and that then claims were subsequently submitted, that you have to show that those claims resulted from, were caused by the illegal remuneration. And several decisions have discussed this concept, and it seems like it is a growing issue in cases involving violations of the anti-kickback statute. I'm interested in your thoughts, Peter and Ginny, about whether there is something here for companies to look to in cases, and your thoughts more generally about whether we should continue to expect to see more enforcement that is predicated upon alleged violations of the anti-kickback statute.
Right. If I may, the most recent case of which you speak is from the Third Circuit, my circuit. So that's U.S. ex rel Greenfield versus Medco Health Solutions, where the allegation was that a specialty pharmacy providing in-home nursing care to hemophilia patients violated the anti-kickback statute by donating to local charities that then recommended them. The case was dismissed. The court held the relator failed to show the company received government payments because of or as a result of the alleged kickback scheme. And this is another example, I mean, in tandem with the Escobar line of cases, that the level of proof being expected by courts now is higher. And now this in the causation element of the False Claims Act, as well as which is closely related to the materiality element. And certainly the defense has more arguments than it did a few years ago on the causation element. And in speaking with prosecutors here, they're worried about this trend. They know it makes their cases harder and their ability to secure settlements and a quick resolution of a case much more difficult, but because of this case authority. That being said, we're still seeing a multiplication of the kinds of cases that allege anti-kickback statute violations. So you would expect that with this increased availability of a defense in at least three courts, in Fifth Circuit, in the Third Circuit, and then District Court in Texas, all supporting this theory that the government must prove that there was a claim resulting from the violation of the AKS, still relators are very creative in coming up with a lot of ways to recast their arguments.
So, Peter, what are your thoughts more generally about where we're likely to see False Claims Act litigation headed in the new year?
You know, Mike, I think I would identify a couple areas that seem likely to continue. The first is anti-kickback statute, because I think we've already seen an increase in that. And Ginny rightly identifies the phenomenon of relator whack-a-mole, which is, you know, as soon as we plug one hole, they come up with another theory or pop up in a different hole, and we have to hit them on the head for that one. I think that, you know, another area that we may still see are claims of medical necessity, but probably things that are a little less speculative and more based on significant evidence of a lack of support for the physician's determination. I think it'd be quite interesting to see where the Department of Justice goes. But, you know, remember, there's always a lag time here, because as trends come up, as they're reviewed under seal, as the department makes a decision whether or not to intervene or not to intervene, I mean, that's a process that can take several years. So the wave as it comes, you know, may be slow in building.
Yeah. I think the only other area that I would add to your list that seems like there is strong interest in the department is in pursuing cases that arise under the Medicare Advantage program. The department has obtained a couple of favorable decisions in the Ninth Circuit, as you're aware, that involve question of the circumstances under which risk adjusting codes for purposes of the Medicare Advantage program can give rise to a false certification and theoretical liability under the False Claims Act. The department has recently settled a very large case involving risk adjusting codes and the Medicare Advantage program, and recently intervened in another case. Guys, thanks so much for your participation. Really appreciate your thoughts and all of your contributions to this.
Thanks for joining us today. For additional analysis on this topic and others around the FCA, please download our latest publication, False Claims Act 2018 and the Road Ahead, from HoganLevels.com.